Greetings. Welcome back to part two of the newsletter. At the end of part one, I'd told you that I was going to look at some of the facts and figures and numbers, because I think it's important to have the statistical information to make up your own mind, and also in case you have to get to a situation where, particularly with some of our more recalcitrant African brothers and sisters who like to play the Negro, it's important to have figures to actually justify your arguments. In the actual written version of the newsletter, I produced tables which you can have a look at, which highlight some of the figures I'm going to go through. And what I took the time to do was to look at the figures for African people killed by the police, and also look at the figures for the killing of police officers by members of the general public of all races. And I wanted to lead you to making your own judgment about the validity of the claim that there is a war on the police in the US, which is at the heart of the so-called Blue Lives Matter campaign, which is, again, typical, just like the All Lives Matter. It's all part of white supremacy's response to undermine the protest by Africans to say that African lives should be protected by the law. Because, of course, you notice in these so-called All Lives Matters campaigns and Blue Lives Matters campaign, they never, ever say that when you kill a police officer, you don't get prosecuted, which is obviously the essential difference. If you kill a non-African, you get prosecuted and you go to prison. You kill an African, if you're a police officer, it's not considered a crime. So in 2015, the police in the US, this is according to the official figures, which to some degree can be underestimated and likely are, because the FBI gathers these data from individual states, and they have noticed when being checked that even some of the more high-profile killings have been missed off from some of the data from time to time. But the official figures in 2015 was that the police killed at least 346 African people. And when I checked, which was, I believe, in early July, in 2016, they'd killed 160 African people. It's obviously moved on since then. So in terms of police officers killed in the line of duty, the place that most people go is the website, the Officer Down Memorial page. And I've given the web link for that website, which sort of memorializes police officers and claims that they're all heroes. And it provided the following figures. So in 2015, 62 police officers were killed in the line of duty. Now, some of these police officers weren't killed by violence. They were killed in accidents, so in aircraft accidents, animal-related attacks, automobile accidents. You had 28 by gunfire. So you also had accidental gunfire. You had heart attacks. You had motorcycle accidents, struck by vehicles, various different types of killings. So only 37 of those killings were actually what you call deliberate killings, gunfire and vehicular assault. And they were the only ones that could be classified as deliberate attempts to kill an officer. And so there were actually there were 47 in total when you had the gunfire ones, vehicular assault, in the whole of 2015. Now, if you go to the website mappingpoliceviolence.org, you get a breakdown of the killings of African people by the police. And there's some interesting things to note. One is the hugely greater number of Africans killed by the police compared to police killed by civilians. And also they give some useful graphics. So, for example, there's one that shows that it's not really about crime, these killings, because fewer than one in three of what they call black people killed by the police were armed and suspected of a violent crime. So 69% were either non-violent or unarmed. And if you look at levels of crime in US cities, it doesn't make any difference to the level of killings. So they've got a map plotting the killings and also the violent crimes per 1,000 population. And there's absolutely no correlation between the level of violence in the city and the likelihood of an African being killed in that city, which again gives a lie to the fact that it's meant to be about crime. Then also, if we think about this concept that policing is such a dangerous job, if you actually go and look up the data, and if you go on, for example, YouTube, the YouTube site of Professor Black Truth, He gives a video showing you that police officers, policing doesn't rank in the top 10 most dangerous jobs in the United States. For example, the most dangerous job is logging. And also garbage collectors are more likely to be killed in their jobs than police officers. So again, the idea that policing is a uniquely dangerous job is simply not true. And also in terms of the murders of police officers, the 2015 figure was actually lower than the 2014 figure. So there's no war against police officers, as has been mooted. So we need to ask a critical question that that needs to be first of all put and then answered. And that question is, why do police officers in the US keep on murdering African men? And actually, this is a very simple question to answer. I've heard lots of convoluted discussions, but it's a very simple answer. And the answer is because they can. And I'll break down how this simple answer came to me. It's really about understanding human motivation. And there are pretty much only two restraints or governors of human behavior. One is internal and the other is external. Now, the internal one relates to a person's morals, ethics, and values. It's about what they believe to be right and wrong, and how they act upon those beliefs in the real world. Because I always say that if you want to know what a person believes, look at how they act, not what they say. Now, the external constraint is divided into two parts, really. And the first part is about what is the likelihood of me getting caught in the act. So you can imagine this is a question a person might be asking themselves in their mind. What is the likelihood of me getting caught in the act of doing something that's prohibited? So for example, you can imagine the idea of a child looking at a jar of cookies or biscuits and mum and dad's not around and thinking, I know I shouldn't take the biscuits because I've been told not to, because I'm on punishment, but I want to eat them because they taste nice. So the child may be asking themselves, what is the likelihood of me getting caught in the act? If their internal constraint, i.e. their moral values, i.e. I should do what my parents tell me to do, doesn't kick in, then we go to the external constraints. The second part of this external constraint is, what will be the punishment if I get caught in the act? So even if you think there's a chance of you being caught in the act, but the punishment isn't really very severe or something you're prepared to tolerate, you may still go ahead and commit the act. So, if a person sees nothing wrong with committing an act through the lens of their personal morality, then the only thing that will prevent them from committing the act is A, the likelihood of being caught, and B, the severity of punishment that we meted out. And we need to be clear that a high likelihood of simply being caught is unlikely to deter the behaviour, especially if there is very little public disapproval attached to committing the act in question. So, it's clear from the evidence of the past 200 plus years that a significant number of mainly, but not exclusively, European police officers in the US see nothing wrong with murdering African men. It's also clear that there's very little disapproval of these acts amongst the majority European population, from the white media, from these murderous officers' colleagues, and from their friends and family. Therefore, even though the chance of getting caught has increased, especially with the proliferation of smartphones, which have got high-quality video recording capability, that in itself is not sufficient, because there's people who used to say, oh, once we get these things on camera, that will put an end to it, because you can see with the crimes that are being committed. But of course, we've seen it doesn't stop it. So we have to then move on to the question of punishment, because we see that being caught in the act is one thing, being charged is something else, being convicted is even more unlikely, and being punished severely is almost unheard of. So let's take the real life example of the murder of Oscar Grant, who was shot in the chest while lying handcuffed on the floor. The murderer, Johannes Messerli, was not convicted of murder, but rather involuntary manslaughter, the lowest form of manslaughter, and was out of prison in 11 months. Meanwhile, his white supporters raised over $1 million for him to ensure he'd have a comfortable life as a semi-retired race soldier who had in effect made these bones. Remember, there's often this idea that in gangs you have to commit a criminal act in order to gain full entry into the gang. And it seems to work similarly in the world of policing and white supremacy. Injuring or killing an African seems to be a way of making your bones and being a lauded race soldier. Again, in the case of Oscar Grant, we have to remember the murder was committed and recorded in a public place, the Oakland Transit System, and there were lots of witnesses there. It was filmed, there were eyewitnesses, and I put the link to news coverage, not only of the murder, but also of Mezali himself, because he's got a penchant for violence against Africans. And he was actually accused of severe violence against another African man, which took place about 3 months before he committed the murder against Oscar Grant. So the foregoing analysis that I've provided, it provides you with a clear explanation of why these acts are going to continue unless and until we can ensure that there are severe negative consequences associated with police officers murdering African men in the US or anywhere else for that matter. Marching and protesting never has and never will change the frequency of these acts. Until some form of negative consequence can be associated with these acts for the perpetrators and their supporters, they're going to continue. So I went back onto the mappingpoliceviolence.org website just to look at the rates of convictions in 2015. So remember I'd said there was, I think it was 346 murders of Africans in 2015. And what we had was that there were no criminal charges in 336 of the cases. Officers were charged in 10 out of 336, and they were convicted in 2 cases. So that was, by my reckoning, a 0.6% conviction rate. And being convicted doesn't mean they were convicted of murder. Remember, you've got all sorts of grades of homicide in the United States. And as I highlighted with the Oscar Grant case, Mezali was let out of prison after 11 months for effectively murdering somebody who was handcuffed on the floor in a public place, and he was filmed and he was released in 11 months. So those two police officers, I haven't gone and checked the cases, but I'm absolutely sure they weren't convicted of murder and they would have spent very little time at all in prison. Okay, now thinking about the context of some of these killings, it's important to note that overwhelmingly the African men that these race soldier police murderers target are invariably poor and down on their luck. And that should be a clear indicator to you as why we need to address our parlous socioeconomic condition. And I'm always banging on about how we need to address our economics. And I was banging on about this even before I became familiar with the works of Dr. Claude Anderson, and his work just reinforced what I'd been saying and thinking before then, independently. And of course, if you look at the works of Dr. Amos Wilson, Blueprint for Black Power, he's always talking about how you need to control your economics if you want to control some of the other aspects of your life. And if you watch Predators in the Wild, you watch a wildlife film, you see that they don't normally go for the strongest. They nearly always seek out the most vulnerable in the herd, such as the newborn, the old or infirmed. If they do attack a strong bull, for example, let's say lions attack a buffalo, who are some of the most difficult prey for them to take down. If they attack a bull buffalo, they'll do it in large numbers. So you might find 7 or 8 lions attacking a single bull buffalo. And they'll do it when that buffalo is isolated so others won't come to its aid. So in effect, when you look at the men who are being murdered, they may be some of them physically strong, but they're economically weak. So they're easy prey because they can normally be characterized as sort of ne'er-do-well. If they're not convicted, they're, you know, the white media's character assassination will paint them as criminals. So we saw that with Eric Garner, who was selling cigarettes on the street. We saw Alton Sterling, who was selling CDs on the street. So they were isolated, they were economically weak, and they were prime victims for these these police goons. And if you think about what's happened recently with the killings of police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge, I've been waiting, I don't know if you've been waiting, to hear the forgive, forgive, forgive talk emanating from the families of the police officers who were slain in Dallas and Baton Rouge. Have you noticed that we haven't heard any of that rhetoric? Even before they're cold, as we do with Africans, where normally the African's families, the African man after he's been murdered, his families will be wheeled out and they'll sing songs about the Lord and how they put their trust in the Lord and how they forgive the murderer and how they want, as in the case of Dylan Roof, even before he'd been properly arraigned, how they wanted him to come to their church if he could, if he wasn't locked up. And you hear this shameful coonery, and then normally what will happen, they'll start saying it's not about race, and that's normally a precursor to getting their large compensation check. And it's shameful to have to even think and say these things, but effectively, before their sons or uncles or partners are even cold in the ground, they'll be singing the song that will get them the largest payout. And it's shameful that the lives of African men mean so little to their own family members that they'll sell out their sons and also sell out their group in order to maximise the paycheck. But you won't hear that from the families of the murdered police officers, will you? And you know the difference why. It's what Mama Marimba Annie calls rhetorical ethic. That there's some things which we're told, but which are only meant for our consumption. And the forgive, forgive rhetoric is something that we've been taught, but it's not meant for general consumption, it's for African consumption. So, why did I call this issue of the newsletter The Purge? Well, the reason why was because of the film. I don't know if you watched Purge, I think they're on to Purge 2 now. But the term purge is it's about eliminating unwanted waste material. You know, we often talk about purging our bodies. I know when I was a child, my mother used to give me these huge laxative tablets near the end of the 6-week summer holiday to give me what she'd call a washout, which would essentially mean you'd be left at home on the toilet for 2 days as your body was being purged. And purging is about getting rid of waste material. And that's the way in which Africans, and particularly African men, are viewed in the United States. And just like in the film of the same name, because you remember in the film, if you watch the film, all laws were suspended from about 7 p.m. in the evening to 7 a.m. in the morning for one night of the year. This was a futuristic film where the proposition was in the film was that law-abiding citizens had these pent-up frustrations due to lawlessness, and if you allowed them to have this purge where they could go out and commit whatever heinous act they wanted to, it would encourage people to be more peaceful. And in the film, crime had fallen significantly since the government introduced this purge, so people were effectively allowed to go and do murder, rape, whatever mayhem they wanted to commit for this one night a year. And of course, in the film, there was an African man who was at the centre of the proceedings as this so-called sort of pseudo-liberal white family gave him unwanted shelter in their home, whilst a gang of sort of upper-middle-class whites wanted him to be released to their tender mercies so they could butcher him. And if we think about what's actually happening, these murders by the police in our contemporary society are actually a vicarious way for white society in the US to vent their deep-seated hatred towards African men. The only difference between the film Purge and the contemporary purge in US society is that in the film, the purge lasted for 12 hours once a year, whereas in the US, the purge of African men is 365 and a quarter days a year, every year. And finally, you need to understand the role of the corporate media and why they always put the African victim on trial. You may recall that the Associated Press went to court to force the release of Trayvon Martin's juvenile record to try to defame his character, whilst they studiously avoided investigating his murderer, George Zimmerman, who had a long history of run-ins with the police, domestic violence committed against his ex-wife and his ex-girlfriend, violent crimes committed against the father of a former partner, and he also had allegations of child sexual abuse made by his younger cousin. Similarly, there's no investigation into the background of these killer cops. They don't investigate to see whether they've had other accusations of violence against people they've meant to have arrested, and particularly violence against other African men. There's just an all-out media assault on the victim. That's why you can never remember the names of the killer cops, but you can always remember the name of Trayvon Martin. You can remember the name of Oscar Grant, but not Johannes Mezzali. So things change and stay the same, unless and until we do something about it. And that something is not singing Kumbaya, my lord, and asking, as Rodney King did, can't we just all get along? So that's the end of part 2. And in part 3, we'll look at solutions.